Hi, everybody. My name is Wishada. Thank you for coming to this presentation and making it to 4:30 today. That's an accomplishment on its own. As our moderator said, I'm the program evaluator and outreach coordinator for the iStar Women's Program. And my presentation today is about trauma prevalence and psychological distress among substance-using women. So before we get started, I need to disclose that I have no relationships to disclose, and also this is my first time at APHA, so I'm very excited, but also very nervous. So I want to acknowledge also that the Integrated Services to Avert Risk Program, or iStar program, is funded by the Department of Health and Human Services under the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, or SAMHSA. So the objective is to examine past traumatic experiences in the context of psychological distress symptoms in the past 30 days amongst a population of substance-using women. So some background. iStar is housed at a nonprofit organization located in Los Angeles County in the city of Long Beach, called Safe Refuge. Safe Refuge aims to provide effective treatment and support services for everyone seeking recovery from addiction. The organization was established in 1988 and has served over 20,000 individuals over the past 27 years. Safe Refuge currently houses 24 grants and contracts and provides substance abuse treatment, sober living, employment services, parenting, domestic violence, and literacy classes, to name a few of their services. The iStar program aims to provide trauma-informed substance abuse and co-occurring mental health treatment and HIV and hepatitis services. The program is targeted to minority women who have substance use or co-occurring mental health and are living with or at risk for HIV and AIDS. Singer proposed the term syndemic to describe the concurrent epidemics of substance abuse, violence, and HIV and AIDS as intertwined health and social problems. He first looked at violence in the context of gang violence and drug-related violence. However, we know that women are disproportionately affected by certain types of violence, such as intimate partner violence and sexual violence. It is estimated that 21 to 39% of women will experience IPV within their lifetime, and this estimate may be underreported. We also know that substance use makes someone more at risk for being a victim or a perpetrator of violence, but also experiencing violence can increase the risk of initial substance use. We also know there are multiple risk factors that are shared among substance use and involvement in violence. These risk factors also take place across the individual, relationship, and community level. At the individual level, untreated behavioral and mental health problems can put someone at risk for substance abuse and violence. Gender, age, education are also indicators of risk. Research shows that in general, men are more at risk for experiencing violence, but women who experience violence are more at risk for substance use and dependency than men. Those between the ages of 10 to 29 are more likely than other users to be perpetrators of violence or victims of violence. Those who have poor school performance are also at risk for violence or drug abuse. At the relationship level, many of the risk factors involve the family, including history of drug use, family structure, involvement, and interaction. But a person's social circle outside of the family may also be a risk factor. At the community level, social inequalities and poverty are linked to violence. Lack of job opportunities and money may cause someone to turn to drug markets and thus the associated violence. The same can be said about neighborhood deprivation. For example, vacant properties and poor outside lighting can allow for drugs and violence to transpire within a community. The iStar Women's Program is a no-cost, 16-week intensive outpatient substance abuse treatment for women. Clients participate in 5 groups that focus on life skills, mind, body, and spirit, family recovery, relapse prevention, and HIV risk reduction, which is the overarching goal. The curriculum is comprised of adaptations of the Boston Consortium model, which is a trauma-informed substance abuse treatment, and Sisters Informing Sisters About Topics on AIDS, or SISTA, which is the HIV education component. Participants also receive an hour of one-on-one counseling and case management with a certified drug and alcohol counselor that primarily uses motivational interviewing. In addition, a marriage and family therapist intern is available to screen participants for co-occurring disorders. If appropriate, the MFTI can provide an hour of therapy on a weekly basis, and participants also join a process group with other therapy patients. Being part of Safe Refuge, clients can also take advantage of the wraparound services that were previously mentioned. Program completers also are offered up to 8 months of additional aftercare. So the methods. The data was collected from the start of the program in October 2013 to January of 2015. Baseline data was collected for 110 women using two different instruments, the Preliminary Intake Assessment and the Government Performance and Results Act, or the GIPRA instrument. SPSS was then used to calculate Pearson chi-square correlation between self-reported trauma history and psychological distress factors experienced in the last 30 days. So the intake assessment is done by Safe Refuge staff and takes personal contact information and background on whether the person has served in the military, is on parole or probation, substance use history throughout their lifetime, previous treatment and program history, and medical and psychological history. The GIPRA is collected by the clients from the clients by the program evaluator, that's me, at baseline, then again at discharge and 6 month follow-up. The data for this presentation was from baseline. This information includes drug and alcohol use in the past 30 days, family and living conditions, SES measures, criminal background, mental and physical health, and social connectedness. Both assessments were read out loud to the participants, and when participants completed a 6 month follow-up, they got a $30 cash incentive. So the results. So these are some of the demographics of the women who reported trauma. So we initially served 110 participants within that window period. 88 women reported having a history of trauma. There were two transgender clients that were served in this window, and both had reported experiencing trauma. The average age was just under 38 years old, and the largest age group was from 25 to 34 years old, 39.8%, followed by 35 to 44 years old, 31.8%. The majority of women who reported trauma were of ethnic minority, single, and heterosexual. The majority also reported having children, housing, but were unemployed. The average treatment duration was 78.7 days of the 120 days to complete the program. So here's a breakdown of the ethnicity among the women who reported trauma. The majority identified as Hispanic, 36.7%, followed by Caucasian, 33%, and African American, 26.1%. The primary drug of choice among clients who reported trauma was methamphetamine, 43.2%, followed by marijuana, 20.5%, and alcohol at 18.2%. Other drugs reported included cocaine, heroin, and prescription medication. Mental health diagnosis. Upon enrolling for treatment, 30.7% of ISTAR participants self-reported a mental health diagnosis. One-third of these women reported having more than one diagnosis. Over half of those who reported a mental health diagnosis reported depression, about one-third bipolar, and a quarter reported anxiety. So results of the trauma assessment. The GRIPRA instrument assesses trauma by asking participants, have you ever experienced violence or trauma in any setting? The definition of trauma includes community or school violence, domestic violence, physical, psychological, or sexual maltreatment or assault within or outside of the family, natural disaster, terrorism, neglect, or traumatic grief. Like I said before, 80% of the participants reported having trauma. Participants were also asked, in the past 30 days, how often have you been hit, kicked, slapped, or otherwise physically hurt? 18.2% reported being physically hurt in the past 30 days at least once, and of which 15.9% responded a few times, and 2.3% responded more than a few times. Follow-up questions to trauma history included, did any of those experiences feel so frightening, horrible, or upsetting that in the past and or present, you have had nightmares about it or thought about it when you didn't want to? Tried hard not to think about it or went out of your way to avoid situations that reminded you of it? 81.8% of clients reported yes to both of these questions. Clients were also asked if, due to the trauma, they were constantly on guard, watchful, or easily startled, felt numb and detached from others, activities, and their surroundings. And almost 70% of clients reported yes to both of those questions. Psychological distress symptoms were measured by asking, in the past 30 days, not due to the use of alcohol or other drugs, how many days have you experienced serious depression, serious anxiety or tension, hallucinations, trouble understanding, concentrating, or remembering, trouble controlling violent behavior and attempted suicide, and been prescribed medication for psychological or emotional problems. Overall, 92.3% of clients who reported trauma history reported being bothered by these symptoms in the past 30 days. And I'll talk more about that. So the Pearson chi-square showed statistically significant association between trauma history and psychological distress factors in the past 30 days for these three questions: experiencing depression, anxiety and tension, and cognitive impairment in the form of trouble understanding, concentrating, or remembering. 65% reported depression, 70% reported anxiety or tension, and over 50% reported cognitive impairment. On average, clients experience these symptoms for 2 weeks or more out of the past 30 days. In summary, there is a statistically significant correlation between trauma history and experiencing depression, anxiety, and impaired cognitive function in the past 30 days. This suggests the need for integrated trauma-informed services to address coexisting issues. This and other research support that trauma-informed substance abuse services accounts for women's experiences of trauma and strategically maximizes women's control over a treatment plan and minimizes the use of interventions that might re-traumatize. Limitations to this research include having a broad definition of trauma as set by the GIPRA instrument, the data collected was self-reported and susceptible to reporter bias, and there was a small sample size. However, my recommendation would be for the grantees in the SAMHSA's cohort of targeted capacity expansion substance abuse treatment for racial and ethnic minority women at high risk for HIV and AIDS to compare across samples, because I suspect that these results will be supported and give more evidence that trauma-informed care is in need among substance-using women. Thank you.
Fear of re-triggering or re-traumatizing someone as they're discussing these or as they're doing the interview. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there was anything that you did to avert that in advance or any standard practices that you had.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of things that SAMHSA, our grant funders, have put out there in regards to trauma-informed care. One of the times when, if I do this interview and they kind of get stuck on the trauma question, I let them know that the follow-up questions will only be for a minute, and that seems to get really good responses. I've had people kind of hesitate, but I haven't actually had anybody refuse to answer that question. And I think that they know we actually got an extra pot of money that if they experience IPV, we can refer out. So I think that helps as well, being able to have these partnerships with other agencies that are also trauma-informed and knowing that if we pass them on, they aren't going to be re-traumatized like you were worried about. That's your program director, by the way.
I was just wondering if you thought about comparing the women who identified as being traumatized in this incident in terms of the demographics and the choice of drugs or their drug choice.
Yeah, in this analysis, there was a bigger population of those who actually reported trauma. So we are a three-year grant, and we're actually starting the beginning of our third year, so that's probably something we'll look at towards the end when we get our whole population.
Mm-hmm. Is that
Yeah, I haven't actually run into that problem, mainly because a lot of the women will report that they haven't been using substances in the past 30 days. Our program is actually certified by the Department of Children and Family Services, and then we also get participants that are referred by their parole or probation officer. So a lot of times reporting may be a little hesitant, but for them, I think they can separate, you know, what is drug use and what's not. And sometimes if they say I have chronic depression, I kind of ask if it's been any worse in the last 30 days or any of the other symptoms.
And whoever is selling them for sex knows that they are an organization that's providing them with support. I mean, that creates a lot
that's
of problems.
That's a great question. Interestingly enough, our trauma-informed court that was developed in conjunction with our program just changed its name to
the human trafficking.
But
the human trafficking.
Their intent is good. The justice system,
they
want to
hand
I'm sure you're aware,
you
they want yeah.
sold.
So they called it the human trafficking court, which our women are like,
as a woman.
Right.
Women
and that's what we that's what we're trying to that's what we're trying to assist them with. But when you have judges that say this is what we want our court to be,
but then move them towards services and support. I mean, one thing is
yes.
labeling. But then, okay, so my question is, does that put those women who are been sold in jeopardy because the pimps know, pimps who could be their parents?
You know, I'll tell you, one of the clever things that the program does is we have what we could call a traditional way for women to get into the program, which means we connect them to services, they get a care advocate, they come to meetings, they do this. But then we also have a non-traditional way, and that's women who never come into anything. But we reach
still
them out on the street. We provide them, we try to help them to get them in. But
so if they say there's
a
risk, we do.
We do
have, so our program does not have a safe house.
But have that.
Yeah, there's four different safe houses now. The criteria, right, to barriers, right? The criteria is domestic violence. So, unfortunately, if they come to us and say, I'm being emotionally abused, the assessors at the safe house go, well, there's no physical violence, so we can't help. So, we do the best that we can. And like when I was talking about the hotels, that's where our women end up. We rent the rooms, we keep them safe in the meantime, once the man gets arrested. Normally, the men that our women deal with, they're dangerous, but they're not like, I've been out to California and Vegas to work with other populations of they're not the same, it's not the same population. They're not as, they don't appear to be as brutal. They don't appear to be as invested in our women. That's a better way to put it. The majority,
they move on if they
yes.
see their commodity is no longer available
correct.
For them.
And that's what happens.
Yeah.
And also, they are, I'll tell you, our police department is amazing with our women. They really are. Like, 10 years ago, we had cops who would go up, I'll never forget, our women would be in the back of the cop car, they'd find the man with the protection from abuse order, and they'd go, just sign this. They all get it. And I mean, we would like cringe, like, oh my God, this is why women don't follow through with it. Where now, they take it serious. I mean, we just had the police just did a full fingerprinting investigation of a woman, her phone, her pocketbook, where we're all sitting going, there's no way they're going to pull anything off of any of that. But they did it. They took the time to do it. They made her feel valued. They made her feel like she was worth their time to do that. And I say all that just to say that they really are invested
yeah,
in getting those men off the street
yeah.
and away from our women,
yeah.
which is helpful.
Yeah,
you know,
I
don't have one with me. I have
a
hotel. But I can,
do
you want me to write?
Too.
We are.
We are not
HIV.
Oh, I don't know
about
Delaware. We are.
Delaware is
yeah.
So does that keep women from agreeing to be HIV tested?
Nope. Our duty to warn does not include, so basically we have to warn We have to call the person if we have their information. We have to, you know, do our due diligence and let them know that someone that they had a relationship with shared or disclosed or is HIV positive. Now, we only have to do that in the event that it's...
You send me a note and I'll...
Confirm that that person... Okay. Confirm that that person actually had sexual relationship with that male.
So
does that make sense? So basically, if I have some, if I test Dr. Stever and she's positive, and she says to me, I haven't had sex with anyone in the past year.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
So the only way that we have to warn is if they say, I slept with John so-and-so who lives at...
So in Indiana, our duty to warn law actually requires that you disclose your status prior to having intercourse. And you can actually get put in jail for not doing that.
No,
and
we do
so,
not have
that. So during our HIV outbreak in Scott County, we have a lot of commercial sex workers who are refusing to be tested because that's their livelihood, that's how they get their drugs, and if they know, then they could actually be committing a crime.
Yep. No, there's no legislation.
No policy.
I know.
You make a policy that makes sense.
I know.
Pennsylvania's
the same way.
But seeing you're preventing women from getting treatment, which in effect, you know, makes you non-infectious any longer, and
right.
So it's just, it's mind-boggling. So these women won't come forward, and we are having a really tough time reaching
what
them.
What state are you in?
In Indiana.
Under in Indiana.
Yeah, we have that HIV outbreak in southern Indiana, in a rural community, 181 HIV-positive individuals in a community of 4,200 people. And a large number of community sex workers, and I think we have 12 that we've identified that are HIV positive, but many, many more who have not come forward to be tested. So, and we have no real access to medication-assisted treatment. Also, so that was my other question. You said that you had women who were had stopped using drugs. Are they in MAT?
We have a combination. So we have our methadone program right now in the county that the WISH program exists in. We have about 1,200 people on medication-assisted treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Huge methadone program.
Uh-huh.
We also do Suboxone Vivitrol.
Right.
So we have a few women who are on Vivitrol. So they went Suboxone, Subutex, Vivitrol that are doing outstanding. We have women who are Suboxone, we have women who are long-term methadone maintenance, and then we have women who went abstinence only, you know, they went detox, transitional housing, recovery home, and who are now sober on no medication-assisted treatment. So we do have a mix. I would say the majority of them are MAT clients. The majority of them are definitely.
So do you see decreases in the commercial sex work of those individuals? Because in our community, the reason they do the commercial sex work is to get the drugs.
So I can give you an anecdotal answer. From a data standpoint, I don't know that we have that information. Because the majority of them are longer-term MAT clients,
right.
So they're still, I don't think we have a significant number that have completed treatment that we would be able to collect the data on, but I can tell you anecdotally, one of the things that constantly blows my mind is that we still have a good amount of women who are sober, who are still participating in the same behavior to pay bills. I mean, job working here, $8.50 an hour, three children, no child support. Our child support system in Delaware is one of the worst out of any state that I've ever experienced, and it's awful. It is awful. And there's no consequences for the men when they don't comply. Same with the FS. When the men don't comply to what they require,
the
no consequences.
No, it's just
so,
yeah.
We just started. So Delaware just started. Our staff, all of our HIV outreach staff at our organization and as well as all the other community providers, were just trained in June.
Mm-hmm.
So
trained to?
Well, trained in how to talk to individuals. So in our state, public health control freaks. So we all went to this mandated training that we had to have, which was all information you literally could have pulled off the internet and educated yourself. So we went in June. So we've all been we've been talking to the clients about it for 3 years now. And we have to wait for them to give us the green light to actually move forward with the approval for the medication to be covered, whether they're for the uninsured and indigent population, which is the majority of our population.
Are you a Medicaid expansion state?
because that's kind of what's going to get
said. Well, so here's what happened. Yes, I do not believe we are yet. I believe